Hey everybody, John Fusco here with our first episode of the No Film School podcast for 2017. I hope everyone is recovering from their New Year's Eves today appropriately. This week, you'll hear an interview I conducted with Johannes Nilholm, where we discuss his experience directing his first feature film, The Giant, which had its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival back in September. The Giant is a movie that's nearly impossible to pin down. Nilholm describes it as a Western, a cheesy sports movie, a drama, a surrealistic fantasy, and a dark comedy all rolled into one. It follows the daily life of an autistic and severely deformed little person named Ricard, whose main ambition in life is to win the Scandinavian championship of Pentank, a European bowling game much like bocce ball. Also, there's a 200-foot giant by his side. Nilholm is a DIY filmmaker through and through. He didn't go to film school, instead teaching himself as many tools as he could through shooting, editing, VFX, and animation, first for music videos and then his own shorts. He is living proof that with the correct tools in place, you can create a movie that doesn't cost much, even though it looks like it does. Hey everybody, it's John Fusco. I'm here with Johannes Nilholm. I'm massacring that, aren't I?
It's a tough one for you, I guess.
Yeah.
It's Johannes Nilholm.
Nilholm?
Nilholm.
Okay. And he's the director and writer of The Giant, which is a film I was lucky enough to catch here at TIFF this year. Why don't you introduce yourself to us, Johannes, and give us a little bit more about yourself. Let us know a little bit more about yourself.
Mm-hmm. I'm a Swedish filmmaker. I live in Gothenburg on the west coast of Sweden. I started my my film career as a music video director. I made a lot of music videos from almost 15 years ago, and then I have an art background as well. I gone to art schools and so, but my real film school, it was making music videos, and then I've gradually evolved towards animation. Doing my own short films when I was fed up with the music video industry. So now this is my first feature film that I'm having a world premiere for here in Toronto.
Great. So you started as a music video director. Can you sort of maybe take us through the leap from music video directing to short film directing, and then we'll talk about the leap from short film directing to feature film directing.
I mean, it was a kind of a gradual move. When doing music videos, it's always so intensely hectic. You have a really, really short of time. You come up with an idea, and 3 weeks later, the music video should be done. So it's really stressful, and sometimes you actually enjoy the idea or the concept of the video and want to continue working with it. So some of my shorts are actually evolved from some actual music videos that I made. Cool. That I continued. Like I made one for Little Dragon. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, yeah. And
what song?
Twice.
Okay.
It was their first video actually.
Oh, cool.
A shadow play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to make that story longer. It was about a girl and a bird, and the girl ended up alone, dying in the forest. She couldn't find her way back home. And then I wanted to continue the story and made a short film that was maybe three times longer with the new music from Little Dragon.
Oh, nice.
So it was kind of the other way around. Instead of getting the music, I made the film, and then they composed to the images instead.
Were they people you knew beforehand, or did they just kind of?
No, they are from Gothenburg.
Okay.
But I didn't know them before making that video. Hmm. But now we are good friends after that. It was a good collaboration.
And you said that you actually started veering into animation from these music videos. We were talking a little bit before the interview about sort of one of the importances of being a sort of low budget, micro budget filmmaker is to have like this knowledge of tools. How would you say that the knowledge of animation or post-production software in that sense has helped you out as a filmmaker?
I mean, all my filmmaking is based on that, the do-it-yourself idea. I mean, as when I worked with music videos, it was me or maybe another guy as well doing everything, like from shooting to editing to doing the VFX and the animation. It was like you were playing around and just learning new stuff all the time. And I mean, I still enjoy very much doing all those kind of hands-on stuff. I still, I mean, even in this feature film, I've done a lot of the VFX in the end. I really kind of enjoy to be down to earth and use my hands mm-hmm. and to have that being seen in the film. I'm not so into this flashy kind of high production value look. Even though maybe this film looks expensive, you have, in some ways.
You have some, yeah, you have some elements of CGI, you know, in the movie and stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of it.
How would you say that CGI can enhance, or like animation, I guess, or VFX can enhance micro-budget features in that sense?
I mean, it doesn't need to cost much, even though it looks like it does. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you can do magic with the right tools, if you know them.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, it's part of the concept to make it look like a documentary, but mm-hmm. then gradually it turns into something else, into a surreal, really beautiful, picturesque fantasy landscape. Mm-hmm. So we have those two worlds colliding, and you're going back and forth between them. It's like a dream world and the harsh reality meeting each other.
Right. And so maybe the VFX are useful in the sense of building that fantasy world and sort of contrasting with the documentary.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Cool. And we wanted that contrast to be really, really big.
Do you think there's something to be said for maybe using CGI sparingly versus using CGI or VFX like, you know, the Avengers or some Hollywood blockbuster would use CGI?
For sure. I mean... it's completely different, of course. I can't compete with that, and I'm not trying to compete with that either. I'm trying to make images that I have in my mind and want them to look like that, and sometimes I'm able to do it myself. Sometimes I need a lot of help from more skilled VFX gurus, but I mean, to make a Hollywood book blockbuster like Independence Day, and so it's mm-hmm. it's kind of out of my league.
Right. Let's talk about some of the strategies that you used. There's these moments in the film where we get a first person perspective from Ricard, where it's, I mean, he only has one eye, so it's you know, and with the little vignette, the circle vignette. But then it also appears as if the screen is sort of like melting, or the figures are melting. Is that something that you did in post, or is that something that you did while shooting? Sort of like
it's analog. It's sometimes a combination. I mean, the vignette, so it's done in post, but the look of the image of the point of view, it's analog. Me and the cinematographer, we went to a thrift store. Is that called a thrift store?
Yeah, thrift store, like a dollar store.
We looked at all the old glasses and vases and everything in glass that we could find.
Yeah.
And looked inside them and saw how it looked.
So you just like put the vase up to the...
Yeah. And then we bought a lot of it. And then the best one, I kind of cut it off and made it into a lens.
Wow. So did you like apply that directly to the camera?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Was there anything else, any other parts of the film where you'd have to do things like that? Or you used sort of practical...
Probably. There was... I mean, there are a lot of analog... effects in it, a lot of apart from those kind of VFX heavy stuff, there are some that's I mean, we use all these kind of traditional techniques with Rickard, he has a mask on him, for example, that looks like it looks really, really authentic.
Yeah.
It looks like it's a real person.
So that was that wasn't an actual deformity that...
No, it's he's a...
No idea.
You didn't know. Okay,
my mind is blown. Yeah.
Okay, that's fantastic. You should have been at the second screening then when he was there.
He was there.
He was there.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people were astonished afterwards that they saw how he looked for real.
Huh.
So he's a real guy underneath them. that's analog effects, of course, but they are it's not meant to be seen as an effect.
Right. Yeah. When, I mean, clearly it wasn't. I'm still kind of
amazed. I'm happy to hear.
So can we talk a little bit about the film while we're on the subject? Why was this an important story for you to tell? It's a hard story, I think, for a lot of audiences to really take in, just because, you know, there's the protagonist is deformed. Mm. There's a lot of mental health sort of issues, which are often shied away from. Why was this an important story for you?
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe I just did it anyway.
Maybe.
I spent 10 years of my life doing unimportant stuff.
Yeah.
Why not? No, but I mean, it's. I have inspiration from many sources. When I was a little kid, I usually had fever dreams that was really similar. They were reoccurring, and I felt like I was trapped in another body, like I had another kind of skin or parts of flesh outside my own body, And when I moved, I could see this this person or this body, those limbs moving, but I felt totally disconnected to it. Mm. And it felt really, it was kind of, it grew some existentialist thoughts in my mind and thinking, if this is not me, where am I? And I had some ideas of afterwards trying to recreate that feeling of alienation from the rest of the world. I mean, I couldn't really communicate with the rest of the world. It felt like I was seeing it from a large distance, from a binoculars turned the other way around. Mm-hmm. I couldn't really get what they were saying, and I couldn't communicate with them. And I've been trying to recreate that that psychological state a couple of times before, and this is what I'm trying to do here as well, in a way, giving this psyche and this psychological state, and trying to have a physical manifestation of it as well in the main character, Rickard, being kind of covered by a thick molds of flesh,
right.
Deforming his face and stopping him from... it's like a filter between him and the rest of the world. You can see that his ears are almost covered, and... Mm-hmm. He only has one visible eye and a small mouth. So you can. It's. I'm trying to recreate some kind of view of an autistic mind. Or I mean, it's not important for me to call it autism. But he's not diagnosed in the film. You don't say what he has or so. But this feeling of being separated from society. Being different, being in the what do you say, in the outskirts of
an outsider sort of
outsider perspective. Yeah, so I'm trying to depict that life in many ways, not just through him, but also I mean through the game he's playing, this petanque game. It's at least in Sweden, it's even more here, I guess. It's kind of an outsider sport. You don't see people play it so much. They are hidden in old factory buildings outside of town, there's a scene in the film where there's a tournament, and one part, the biggest part of the tournament in this big hall, they are playing beach volley.
Yeah.
And in one little part of the hall, it's the Nordic Championship of petanque, and they they always get those beach balls, beach volleyballs in the backs, and it's kind of really destroying the focus for
and
the players.
The disparity between the two audiences too. I mean, you know, one of them is obviously a much more popular and sexy game than the other. So.
So it's kind of a big contrast. I'd like to see that, to build up that contrast between the outsiders and the rest of the world, and the kind of trying to also show that everyone is an outsider from some perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you use a character and I guess a game to sort of manifest that within a script. This seems like kind of a stupid question to ask now after having met you, because it doesn't seem like you'd want to categorize this film under any genre, but you know, if you could, what sort of like genre would you say this is, or are you interested in?
Yeah, but of course I thought about that. I mean, I can see so many different genres weaved into this. I mean, there's some kind of a Western theme going on there with the, instead of shooting bullets of lead, they're shooting balls of steel mm-hmm. at each other, like weapons.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of story of the lonely guy riding towards the sunset.
Yeah.
Yes, it's
the score too evokes sort of like the Western, like Sergio Leone.
Yeah, for sure. This desolate, melancholic whistling music. And you have Rickard riding his tricycle instead of a white horse towards the sunset. So, I mean, it's the Western theme is in there. It's a, I mean, it's a cheesy sports movie in one way.
Yeah.
It's a dark comedy. It's a surrealistic fantasy drama in one way. I mean, it doesn't really make sense to... I mean, the idea of... generalization or saying a film is a specific genre is for people to understand what kind of film it is.
Exactly.
So I don't think people will be any wiser to I'm trying to explain it. It's a different film in that aspect, but still I think it's a pretty easy film to follow anyway.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's an accessible, it's because you have sort of the, you know, you say it's like a cheesy sports film and you have that sort of to guide the audience's perspective while assaulting them with all this like sort of surrealist ideology. Can we get into some of that surrealism? How does like surrealism aid you as a storyteller?
I mean, I've always been fascinated with magic. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a magician or a clown.
Yeah. And
then I thought that filmmaking could combine that.
Yeah,
too. I also wanted to be an actor at some place, at some time.
There's still time.
I'm doing it sometimes also.
Good.
Only in my own movies.
Were you in this film at all? Did you make
I had to be there. There was one party scene at this. It was really long shots with a lot of people, and to be able to direct it, I had to be in the scene to kind of not be too obvious a director. So I had to play the part of a party goer.
Cool. Hard part.
Sometimes
to play.
You actually see me, if you look closely, you can see me directing the main character in the background.
Oh, really? How was it directing sort of the mentally handicapped or the...
For me, it wasn't at all different from directing the rest of the actors. Mm. There are so many amateurs, not professional actors in the film. There's almost no professional actors in the film. And I mean, I worked in a similar way with all of them, trying to build their confidence, trying to get to know them so they trusted me.
Mm-hmm.
And also so I could kind of see what they wanted to do, what was going on in their mind, so I could kind of blend their own personalities a bit into the characters that they were playing.
Right.
And I worked the same with all the amateurs in the film. Like trying to see what was going on in their life and trying to make that enhance my ideas of what they were going to do.
Interesting. What is it like making films in Sweden or Scandinavia? I mean, you said you didn't go to film school.
Mm.
Is it easy to break into the scene there? Is it a flourishing scene? Is it...
I think it's always tough to do things for the first time. If I mean, it works very different from here. It's financially, you can get support from the state. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have here. You have more like censorships and that kind of stuff, and the studio system, yeah. Of course,
yeah.
And the private investors. So, but a big part of the financing of the film is state support, often half of it or so. But it's really hard to get it,
yeah.
Extremely hard, especially if you haven't done much before, mm. If you haven't the right contacts. So it's really hard. So for me, before I had my films getting into the hot festivals, I couldn't finance my own films. But after that, it was a bit easier. It's not easy. It's always a tough work to convince people, mm. To believe in your projects. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, I mean, there's some stuff I like in working in Sweden. Of course, I like the language. In Gothenburg, for example, we have a lot of filmmakers. There's a film school there. There's a lot of people, independent mm-hmm. filmmakers there. That's and a lot of talent. That come and go between the different productions. There's also tough rules that you have to follow. If you're doing films the way you should do films, that is supported by the state. There comes a lot of rules you have to follow.
What sort of rules?
Associations that help actors, that help the directors, and those associations are really governing their people really, really tough. Mm-hmm. When I started to make films, I wanted to do my best, and I could work from early in the morning to the late of the night. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have fun. I could kind of put all my energy in it. But now there's so many rules that stops both me and the other talents from actually doing it. Mm-hmm. Everyone is really afraid of getting used, doing stuff and not getting paid. So I think more energy is wasted on making sure that you are not getting used mm-hmm. than actually trying to do something.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because we have SAG and sort of like unions around that too. Mm. But that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, if you're fully invested, and if your cast is fully invested in having a great time shooting this film, why shouldn't you be able to like film all the time? You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course, it's good with unions protecting you. It's not that, but it's. I think there's those rules. There's so many surreal rules. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of a surreal rule.
Yeah.
When I shoot in Gothenburg, if I have the kind of the headquarter of the production in one place, every day should start for all the people should start at that place. If I had have a location 2 hours from there, then you count 2 hours to the location and 2 hours back. Even though actually no one goes to the headquarters in the beginning, you pretend like they do. So everyone meets
at the location
2 hours later. So you lost 2 hours there, and then you lose 2 hours afterwards. So you have 4 hours of shooting instead of 8 hours. People get paid for 8 hours doing 4 hours, and to me it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It forces you to find locations really close to the headquarter. Mm-hmm. So I mean, most of this film is shot at the parking lot of the headquarter. Not really, but a bit of it in a way, sort of.
Cool.
I think it's it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous rules. It doesn't make sense.
Oh. Not at all, especially if you're, you know, have a micro budget or you have a very limited resources to work with. So I guess a few more questions. One, what was the jump like from, we talked about earlier what the jump like from music videos to shorts was. What was this jump from short to feature like for you?
The biggest difference is that for this feature, at least, I'm working on a feature as well, which is completely different production-wise. But with this feature, the big jump was that I'm not producing it myself. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of more people that I usually work with. There's such a big crew and so many people in front of the camera. So for me, it was a big, big leap. Mm-hmm. And the main struggle for me was to get to learn all these new ways of how to make a film.
Right.
I like to put myself in situations where I'm out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So I succeeded with that. I was totally out of control in many situations, creating a little bit of a chaos. It got out of my hands in many ways, yes, because I don't decide all of it anymore, mm-hmm. since I'm not producing it.
True.
A lot of other people are deciding stuff over my head.
So wrapping it up then, if you had any piece of advice, any nugget, any good, like your best piece of advice for emerging filmmakers or for filmmakers who are trying to make their first feature, what would you say?
I would say get your own technology, get your own camera, get your own equipment, work with people you know, people you can trust, produce it yourself, so you learn all that aspect of the filmmaking as well.
Mm-hmm.
Learn all aspects of the filmmaking, learn all the rules of it so you understand it all. You can start small scale and then gradually grow. I think
that's like 18 pieces of advice. That's great.
I have another one, which is even better.
Yeah.
But I won't tell you now.
Okay. We'll wait till the next one comes out and then you can give us that. All right, Johannes, thank you so much for talking with us. It was great. And everyone should check out The Giant if they get a chance. It's a very surreal movie.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for listening. I know you missed the rest of the No Film School gang, Emily, Liz, Charles, everyone. So good news, we're back for Indie Film Weekly this Thursday. Be sure and tune in for all the latest filmmaking news, grants, and festival deadlines and gear information. I was John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at @Jim_John_Jim. If you've liked what you heard today, be sure and head over to iTunes, subscribe to the No Film School podcast, and help us start the year off right by giving us a 5-star review. We'll see you on Thursday.